Welcome to Macro Memo, a Board Agenda podcast exploring the impact of macroeconomics and geopolitics on business with Mark Kennedy, George Lagarias, and hosted by Gavin Hinks. To access thousands of articles, guides, reports, and our upcoming events, sign up or log in at boardagenda.com. That's boardagenda.com. This episode is brought to you by Forvis Mazars, the international audit, tax, and advisory firm helping businesses around the world operate and grow with confidence.
Hello and welcome to the Macro Memo. My name is Gavin Hinks, editor of Board Agenda, your essential source of corporate governance news and insight. And this is our regular briefing on the macro trends affecting business and trade. The summer is over. We're all back to work and a dramatic working landscape lays before us. The geopolitical environment continues to be a source of uncertainty. The UK's new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, appears to be applying a salve to EU wounds, and we're looking forward to a rate cut from the Fed following on from those in the UK and Europe. As they say, we are cursed to live in interesting times, and with us, hopefully, to lift the malediction, our time-honored guest, George Lagarias, joining us from Athens. Hello, George.
Hello.
Hello. And joining George is Mark Kennedy, tuning in from Dublin. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Gavin.
Thanks for joining us, both of you. Now, it's been a whole summer since we last spoke. I realize you've been sunning yourselves somewhere, potentially. George, what's been on your summer deck chair reading list?
An interesting book on global debt called This Time is Different by Reinhardt and Rogoff. It's a 2009 book, so just around the time of the global financial crisis. And it tells a story about how we pile up debt, but think that this time is different and we will not have to pay it off.
Why was that interesting summer reading?
Well, for one, because I'm a boring person, but also because we do see debt accumulation happening much faster. We even see it in China. You know, China, interestingly, had 57% debt to GDP in 2018. It's projected to be nearly twice as much by the end of 2028. The US is piling up debt very quickly. So, you know, we have this antagonism of two great geopolitical superpowers, and it's all debt-based. So you're sort of wondering where it all ends up.
Very much so. And I think we'll come back to those issues in a little while. Mark, I hear you've had a staycation. You've been in West Waterford in Ireland, and that's given you some pretty stark observations as well.
Well, yeah, look, West Waterford is a beautiful part of the world. For those in the UK, it is. It's somewhere between St. Ives and Pembroke on the opposite side of the Celtic Sea. So you can imagine the kind of climate. It's not a place you go to sun yourself very much. And we've holidayed there for years. And I suppose the observation is that aside from it being a lovely, quiet, beautiful place to spend the summer, the Celtic Sea is warming at an unprecedented state. So it's warmed in the last 15 years almost as much as it had in the previous 30 to 40 years in terms of average temperature. And it's not alone in that, but it's just when you visit a place again and again, you start to see the impact. And one of the big impacts there is that the local fishermen are now very concerned about cod stocks, and are the scientists who monitor that kind of thing over here in Ireland are building in the impact of global warming and sea temperature warming in particular on things like cod stocks, and it's already starting to have an impact. So just from a very quiet, peaceful part of the world, an interesting observation of what is probably a bigger issue than most issues we have to deal with day to day.
Yeah, quite unsettling. And you've both delivered rising figures, rising temperatures and rising debt levels. So well matched on that score, at least. Look, now to our main agenda, geopolitics. It's hardly worth reminding everyone that conflicts still continue in Ukraine and Gaza and Sudan as well, perhaps the biggest one that goes very much unmentioned. And we have the unraveling position in Bangladesh. But we've got another big event coming up on the geopolitical landscape, and that's going to be the US presidential election. That may change things yet again. Mark, does business look to the election with some trepidation in terms of its impact on business opportunities and trade?
I wouldn't say trepidation. I think business people will always look at elections of, you know, the US election is obviously one of the biggest in the world in any given period. They will look with interest. I think they will look to try and understand what the policies that different candidates will put forward and what does that mean for the trade landscape. I think probably more of a concern for many international businesses is particularly those that are touched by some of the countries that you've mentioned in your intro is the impact on trade and supply of conflict in different parts of the world. So I don't think trepidation is the right word for the US election. I think that in reality, and I think the market has priced this in to an extent, there isn't a huge difference between the two parties in the US at the moment on a lot of economic issues. And I think that's what people will be looking at and then trying to understand the nuances maybe of tax policy or of trade policy that may emerge from one candidate or the other as they head towards the election.
George, that's an interesting observation, isn't it? Not a lot of difference between the two parties over economics. That possibly means that debt, as we've already mentioned, will keep rising in the US, and we'll also have at least some kind of maintenance of the protectionist position that's taken over the last few years.
Both of the statements are correct. Fiscal incontinence in the US will continue under most scenarios. Simply put, none of the two major parties can afford to lose voters in key swing states. Remember, it's not just this election. There is the next one in 2 years and the next one in 2 years after that. So, you know, this is an ongoing process. The U.S. is always in some sort of election cycle or another. So fiscally, they need to keep things going because growth is in and by itself is not supporting issues like the reindustrialization of the North. So definitely right on the fiscal front and protectionism too. But where there is a difference is in potential outcomes. So how you reach supremacy for the Republican agenda, it could be it could have more to do with dollar devaluation and possibly an interference with the Fed to keep rates low. With Democrats, it might be a little bit more for a stronger dollar, at least if they follow Biden's playbook. Okay, so this is a key difference. And also, fiscally, there could be a difference, at least in the, not in the extent of fiscal spending, but in the mix, in that Republicans are vying for tax cuts. Just as a reminder, last time taxes, corporate taxes were cut from 35%, I think, to 21%. And now the Democrat Party, if they win, they are considering raising them by 7%. Republicans, on the other hand, are promising to cut them by a further 2%. Okay, so there could be a key difference in the tax regime.
Mark, that's is a really interesting point there in the big picture stuff may stay the same, but if the approach to currency is very different, that makes it quite a different trading partner for the rest of the world.
Yeah, it does. And George is far better qualified than I am as an economist to kind of unpack the differences there. But again, I think in the similarity, I mean, America is in the business of being business, as somebody said, you know, being in business, somebody said a long, long time ago. I do think we have seen a more protectionist perspective coming from the States in recent years. And taking the long view, that's not that unusual, actually, you know, if you look at the history of the 20th century. So I think what business people will do is try to understand the scenarios and the ranges that are there between one and the other. I think there will be plenty of flagging by whoever is the next president as to what changes will be made. And I think businesses will adapt to that. And yes, clearly there are differences. If George picked a difference on tax or a difference on the approach to the dollar value. But businesses will adapt to that over time. You know? So again, I wouldn't go back to, I don't think there's a sense of fear about it. I think there's a sense of wanting to understand which route would be taken.
Quickly though, Mark, how do they adapt to that, to a rising dollar or a falling dollar? What's the adjustment you make?
Well, it depends entirely on what kind of business you're in. But if you're, so it depends, are you net importing or net exporting to the US, and what's that going to do to the value of assets that you're holding in dollars, or the debts you may need to meet in dollars and so on. So I suppose if one is buying a lot from the US and the price of what you're buying is going up because of the change in the dollar strategy, you're going to have to hedge against that. You know, you'd be going to your banker to try and make sure that you can do that in a very simple way. But, you know, larger companies will have very complex treasury operations to manage that kind of risk for them. So I think the change here is that, you know, if you have a level of volatility, it becomes very difficult for a company to manage in that scenario. But where it's understood and it's expected and people can see that change, companies have tools and techniques that they'll use to manage that. So they minimize the cost to them ultimately.
George, very quickly, do other governments adjust to the post-election American economic environment in some way themselves?
They do, but it's always a question of how fast and how they can adjust. So, for example, a country like China may adjust faster than the European Union. Okay, where, you know, in the European Union, there are many voices heard, and by the time you have a cohesive foreign policy, it could be months. Whereas in China, there is probably already a playbook for each of the two possible outcomes. And just to be clear, the outcomes, actually, I'm being facetious, the outcomes are not two, they're multiple, because there are two presidents, but there are also two probabilities for the House and two for the Senate. Okay, and all of them are a coin toss. So there is a multitude of outcomes. The Senate is responsible for appointments, Supreme Court and what have you, and foreign policy. The House is responsible for the budget, and the president is responsible for a host of things. So you have many iterations of what the U.S. government might look like.
So too early to say what we're going to get post-election at this moment, but a moment of uncertainty nonetheless. Look, let's move on. The other big development that we've seen over recent weeks, of course, I mean, we had the UK election, which changed government. We have a Labour government. The new Prime Minister is Keir Starmer. And last week, Starmer was out and about in Germany and France, obviously in the process of trying to reset relationships with Europe in some way. Is that how we should read it, Mark, for business? Should business be cheered by the prospect of the UK getting closer again to Brussels and European countries?
I think so. I think the visits that the new Prime Minister made to Germany and France and the reception he had are very positive. It definitely shows a softening of the stance in terms of the post-Brexit relationship. That said, I wouldn't get too carried away with it yet. I mean, the devil is in the detail in terms of our relationship between the UK and the EU. And it's much more important what the respective, the EU on one side and the UK does going forward in terms of managing tariffs and trades, managing the review of goods going in and out and inspection processes and all that we've heard about in recent years, and managing particularly things like financial services regulation. So I think that's where we're going to see whether this is moving somewhere constructive in the longer term. But certainly it's a good start, and I think it was a very positive message and very positive symbolism politically to see those meetings taking place, and the tone of the meetings afterward, or the feedback afterwards, I think was good.
George, good symbolism in the meetings, but there was that tantalizing talk in Germany of a bilateral agreement. But many people reading about that, including myself, would have wondered, you know, what room does Germany have for maneuver, being a member of the EU, to do something with the UK? And it's worth bearing in mind, the bilateral agreement said they would have joint priorities on foreign policy cooperation, growing our economies, and industrial transformation. So it sounds as if they were trying to edge closer on business in some way. But as I mentioned, where's the room to do that?
So, not being an expert in European law, it is my understanding that the EU negotiates trade agreements as a whole. There are no bilateral agreements between trade agreements between the EU and other nations. Having said that, in terms of foreign policy, that can be a little bit more bilateral. And I suspect that's where things are going. Again, having said all that, we have to look at the electoral results in Germany today, which would remind ourselves that the coalition government is not the most stable right now. A lot of things might be thrown up in the air for political purposes or for niceties or what have you. But ultimately, Germany does not have right now a stable government, and France has an interim government for the past 3 months. Okay, so the larger picture here is that of more constant geopolitical volatility, and trade agreements happen in an environment of more relaxation, of more stability. That's when you get the trade agreements. Trade happens when you're stable. But when either of the two parts remains unstable, the UK was unstable for a long time, now the EU is more unstable than the UK, then it's very difficult to reach that agreement because both sides of the equation keep moving.
Mark, it is a very difficult world in which to create an environment of stability at the moment for business and economics to improve.
I think, yeah, as a general statement, that's true. And we've been, for a number of years now, I think, conscious of the level of volatility in the world and what that does for business. And I agree with George in a way that home politics will matter more, you know, I think, in the coming year or perhaps years than it has in terms of establishing that. But at the same time, the trade agreements and agreements of that nature don't change quickly. And so I wasn't expecting that Keir Starmer would come home and we'd have a new arrangement either with Germany in relation to some of the headings that you've mentioned, which I think are national competences rather than EU competences, or that there'd be a new EU deal. I don't think that's something that's going to happen overnight. This is a long, long, slow process that will be worked out by senior civil servants over months and years. So while I agree with the backdrop point about volatility, I think where there's opportunities for countries to establish competitive advantage for themselves and or for the EU as a bloc to do that, to bring benefits to their citizens, they will gradually take those opportunities. And I think what was interesting about the period of visits in the summer was it was a statement about collaboration and wanting to work together on those, which is a tonal change. And I think that's really what its significance is. And I thought it was interesting that if you pick the couple of headings too that stood out for me, one is on the foreign policy side. Managing migration is a big issue for all of the three countries mentioned, and it is something they can work together on. And I think will bring positivity even to businesses over time. And the other is, I think when you talk about industrial change, you've got to also, I think, factor in things like digital issues. And that's an area that's developing very fast. And there's a lot of new legislation there. So again, it's an area where some cooperation probably helps UK and France and Germany. So I'd see it positively from that perspective.
So what we can look forward to, presumably, is a situation where the UK and the EU gradually sort of accretes closer relationships. It's a gradual approach where they put together small pieces over time.
I think so. And I think each success in that kind of process will give both sides some confidence that you can build something that is meaningful over time. You know, the reality is the UK is out of the EU. It is not going to go back into the EU anytime soon. So it's a different game. And, you know, I'm not expecting drastic change. I think it's more gradual change is what we'd hope to see. And that can be positive for businesses. One of the things I read while I was away was an interesting article on UK businesses and the real impacts of a lot of smaller businesses. And there's a lot that can be done there, you know, in terms of easing the passage for workers that are needed in the UK economy, dealing with some of the administrative headaches that people face when they're trying to export into the EU or buy things from the EU. You know, that's an agenda I think that the civil service will be working on gradually, because it brings real benefit to citizens ultimately. You know?
George, a gradualist approach building up then between the UK and Europe?
Yeah, so several points there. One, to second Mark's point, it is much easier to demolish than it is to build, let alone rebuild. Okay, but the things never became so acrimonious that relationships would be destroyed for a generation or so. Okay, and that is what we must keep. It is natural for the UK to keep close ties with two-thirds of its trade, which is the European Union, especially at the time when the United States is taking a more isolationist approach. Okay, so I think this is a natural state of things, and where there will be a way. I'm 100% behind Mark here. I think the volatility is what's going to make it more gradual probably than otherwise. But we will begin to see steps towards a direction of more cooperation. And no one has ever said, even the most ardent Brexiteers, that they didn't want cooperation with the EU. Where I suspect is going to be an issue is who adjudicates whatever trade treaties. Is it the European Court of Justice? Is it some third court? Is it UK courts? So because this is a very sensitive issue, especially the ECJ for Brits, I suspect that's the particular devil at the details that Mark was mentioning.
That's a big one to overcome, isn't it, Mark? Well, we'll leave it at that then. Definitely a hard one. Right. The last of our issues on our agenda this week is the prospect of a rate cut in the US by the Fed. They've got a meeting on the 17th and 18th of September. A cut has been trailed. There was some disappointment. We didn't have a cut earlier in the year. But Jerome Powell of the Fed has said the time has come in one statement. Are we optimistic, George, that the rate cut is on the way? You're usually quite bearish, so I did wonder whether you thought there was still a chance we wouldn't see anything this year from the Fed.
There was a time around the beginning of the summer where the data didn't look too good. But I have to say I changed my mind a little bit on one particular point. So number one, yes, I am optimistic about rate cuts. Two, I think we'll see at least two this year from the Fed. And three, and more important, I think that this really leaves room open for the Bank of England and the EC, the European Central Bank, to do more rate cuts, because they have to battle much lower growth. The US is doing rate cuts with potential growth of 2%-ish. Okay, maybe a little less, maybe a little more, but there. In the EU, it's less than 1%. And in the UK, it's the same. So they have more room to cut rates, but they couldn't get started for fear of capital flights until the Fed got started. So the Fed giving the okay and say, okay, we're entering a rate cut cycle, which in Jackson's Hole, they were pretty adamant about, because now they're looking at unemployment. That opens the door for more from European banks. The one thing I want to add, and this is where I'm slightly changing my pessimism, is that I know so far, and that's what the data had been telling us, that China had been deflating goods, but services inflation remains too high. So just this week, I read a very interesting article in Foreign Affairs from a Chinese policy expert who more or less explains that China is a deflation machine, whether it wants it or not. As long as its economy remains open, it has built so much industrial capacity that it will export deflation. What Mark a year ago called potential dumping of goods in the EU and the US. And it's just their machine, the way the economy works, that they can't help it. which means I'm more optimistic about China's potential to keep deflating goods until our own Western services inflation is low enough to get interest rates back to normal. So I'm a little bit more confident now that we will not see a rebound in goods prices, except if there is a big geopolitical event.
Mark, the Fed seems to have been very worried, much more worried about the consumer environment in the US in recent times. But that background with China does make it a very interesting environment for the Fed to make decisions on a rate cut.
Yeah, I think it does. I don't have a lot to add to George's analysis. I think that point about China is very important. And I think the Fed, they're going to, I think, play a very canny game on that and be careful as they progress. The one thing I might just go back to is George's comment about the opportunity in Europe. I think there's more nervousness in Europe about it. And I think there's an interesting feature in that the European Central Bank leadership seem to have set themselves a target of trying to get back to 2% inflation by 2025. I think there's also commentary from some of the members on watching employment in as George has said, a low growth environment. So I think there's a bit of caution, and you heard that from Philip Lane, who's the chief economist in the ECB, when he spoke at Jackson's Hole. And so, I think we will see positive steps. I think there's a bit of a fear of a softening in the US, so I think they will take steps that are positive. Europe, I'm a little bit more cautious, but if I remember correctly, George, you correct me on this, I don't think the ECB has a mandatory inflation target or employment target in the way some central banks do. So it's
No, they don't. In fact, the inflation target is more or less self-imposed. They have an inflation mandate, but the inflation target is more or less self-imposed. And that 2% exists in academic literature, to be sure, but it's not a thing that's set in stone. It's a thing that became, I think, 20, 30 years ago, tops. So there's always academic room to maneuver around it. And the 2.5% might be a potential future.
Yeah, and that's my point, really, that I think, despite the bit of caution, I think there is room to maneuver there, which is probably good for everybody, whether you're looking from a US perspective or a European perspective.
Mark, staying with you, if the Fed does cut rates this month, we'll see anything between 0.25 and a half a percentage point, I imagine. How will business feel that?
Well, I think there is a concern there that there's a little bit of a flattening in terms of consumer expectations at the moment, and that, so I think the most immediate way I'd expect, and again I bow to George's knowledge as an economist of how the cogs in the economy will work through, but I think the hope would be that you'll see a bit of an uplift in consumer behavior before we get to the end of the year. I think that's positive in the States, and it'll also have a positive impact perhaps on some business actions as we go forward. I at the same time, again, bit of summer reading, there was a couple of interesting pieces on the lack of correlation between interest rate environment and investments by businesses, that it doesn't flow as neatly as there. So again, I think I suspect more it's on the consumer side that we'd see a positive uplift in the short term.
That's really interesting. George, we're looking at a bumper Christmas, and that point about business not necessarily jumping on all over cheaper money with interest rate cuts. That's quite pertinent, isn't it?
Yes. Look, I think as a generation, it's the first time in 20 years we experienced really high rates. And it's the first time in nearly 40 years that we experienced inflation. So there has to be some sort of trauma associated with it. Economy has a lot to do with behavior. I've always resented the idea that economics is mathematical formulas. I think it's far from this. So it has to do with behavior. And I think that 2 years of high inflation are going to give us a different type of consumer, at least for the next 3 or 4 years, as long as the relevant trauma is recent and pertinent. And then things will change. You know, the 2008 global financial crisis has been at the top of everybody's mind for a good 10 years after it happened. And now we rarely discuss it.
So, Mark, that's quite interesting. Consumer behavior is somewhat fixed at the moment. So that's not necessarily an incentive for business.
I think there's probably been a bit of a theme as we've gone through different issues that change is, well, there's a lot of volatility in the environment. Change isn't necessarily abrupt. And I think George is right. Consumer behavior is fixed by lots of things in the real world. I mean, models will tell you one thing, but in reality, people make ends meet, and you know, their real world doesn't change that rapidly. So I think what businesses will be hoping is that there's some uptick, and that what seems to be a little bit of a trend of nervousness about consumer retrenchment will dissipate a bit. And as you run through October and the kind of sales season and into the year end, that you start to see some positivity. But I wouldn't expect anything drastic. And I think and businesses will plan on that basis. So I think George has a good point there. Slow change everywhere, Gavin, is the message, I think.
Slow change everywhere. And a premium on planning, decent planning, whilst keeping an eye on macroeconomic developments. Well, I think that's a good moment to wrap up there. Guys, let me just, before we go, get your views, whether you're feeling bullish or bearish at the moment, given you're probably feeling refreshed after your summer holidays, despite the geopolitical economic environment. Come to you first, Mark, bullish or bearish at this moment?
Well, you know, I'm a bit of an optimist, so I'm bullish coming back from holidays. And I think that I was casting my mind back to the narrative, you know, at the start of 23, again, end of last year, start of 24, as we went into the current year. And it has been very negative. There's been a lot of discussion about volatility. There's been a lot of commentary about things that could be quite catastrophic. And what we've seen is that most things get managed, whether it's by businesses or by governments. Even the election kind of outcomes that people were hailing at the start have gone, you know, mixed, but things have muddled along. So I think from that kind of starting point of, we could have had very difficult times, I'm quite optimistic that the institutions that make the world spin around are gradually dealing with things and we're moving in the right direction.
George, do you share those sentiments? Is your summer glow making you feel optimistic?
I think that glow that you're seeing is my bald head. No, I would say I am manifestly bullish and inherently bearish. And just to qualify that, things are looking good and the short-term risks are abating. You know, lower rates, markets are doing well. Lower rates also means that we probably cross the Rubicon in terms of having something break in the markets due to higher rates. And now that's probably has less of a probability of happening. But also I do see background risks, especially those related to high debt and geopolitics rising. So to qualify this, and in terms of investments and in terms of economics, I think things are looking good now. I would be careful about event risks. So maybe I'd buy a new, modest new house, but would I over leverage myself to buy a big new house with a pool? Less so. There is a limit to my bullishness.
Well, that seems fair enough. And who can afford a pool anyway on our pay? Well, that seems like the appropriate time to draw a halt to this conversation. Mark Kennedy, George Ligarius, thanks for joining us in this edition of the program, and thanks to everyone out there for logging on. Thank you and goodbye.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
That was a podcast brought to you by Board Agenda. To get the best in boardroom thinking and access a hub of expert insight, intelligence, and resources for boards and directors, sign up or log in at boardagenda.com. That's boardagenda.com.